College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandi.
Week two is in the books, and we have plenty to cover this Monday morning. As he does every Monday, Kirk Herbstreit joining us to discuss what he saw from the weekend, what he liked, what surprised him, what he can't wait to see this upcoming week, which will be week three of the college football season. Herbie, great to have you with us. How was the Austin experience for you going back a decade later?
Man, it was awesome. We had just a great weekend. You know, it's a great town. I mean, you've been down there. It's one of those towns where you look forward to going in. The great food. It was a little hot, but not hot like you're down in the south in the humidity, but hot like you're inside an oven hot. Like it's just sticky. But overall, just an amazing trip. Great game. I mean, anytime a game lives up to its billing, two quarterbacks kind of going toe-to-toe, just an overall amazing weekend. We had a great game day in the morning, had fun with Matthew McConaughey, came on as our guest picker and had fun with Coach Corso taking off his tiger head and throwing it. So
I had a little issue with Matthew McConaughey. He went a little too much on the franchise there. I was like, take it easy on the head when you're taking the headgear off here with Coach.
I know. He went after it. You know, the only person that's ever done that before is, you know, probably Katy Perry, who took off the big elephant of Crimson Tide. So Roll Tide that day didn't work out, and they ended up losing the game. This time he went with the Tigers and they prevailed. So yeah, but just a lot of fun. And you know how it is. It's week two. There's storylines everywhere and excitement and upsets brewing and a lot of fun as you guys had throughout the day as well.
Yeah, it was great. There were some disappointments. We were expecting a closer game in a couple matchups, especially the opener, because Ohio State looked fantastic against Cincinnati, which was surprising because I thought the Bearcats defense would put up a little bit of a fight. But let's go back to that nightcap, because that was the best game when you're looking at primetime and our expectations. What did you learn about LSU? What did you learn about Texas from that experience?
Well, I guess first with the team who won the game, LSU, we came in talking a lot about this new offense that LSU might have. And Joe Brady came over from the Saints, spent some time with Drew Brees and Sean Payton. You and I talked about this last week. Everybody talked about it. George Whitfield, our quarterback guru, went there and visited with Burrow. And so it was very, very well documented, and it's been talked about on a local and national level. And, you know, they didn't really show a ton in their first game against Georgia Southern, didn't really need to. And here they are on the road in Austin. Let's see. We've been hearing about it. Let's see this new offense. Keep in mind, as you know, LSU's notoriously been known for conservative approach. Let's win with defense and our athletes, and let's do just enough on offense. So it was a very, very drastic change for LSU to try to become an offensive team and an attacking team. And sure enough, right before our eyes on that big stage, Joe Burrow, in complete command of this offense, builds a lead early. And then it got interesting in the second half because Texas, as you expect them to do, came back, made a game of it, and in fact looked like they might be able to pull out of there with a win. And just when it looked like that might happen, you got to give credit to LSU because they kept instead of taking their foot off of the accelerator, if anything, even with the lead, I said with 4 minutes to go, they got the ball back. Texas is back in this game. How are they going to approach this? Are they going to get conservative with a 6-point lead? Or are they going to attack? And man, they attacked. That third down call was legendary. I thought they possibly run the ball on third. Third and 14.
Yep, yep.
Third and instead of running and making Texas use their last time out, they throw it and maybe a touchdown for LSU fans they'll remember for a long time, because not only converting, but it turns into a touchdown. And just a remarkable effort by Burrow, by the offense. And also, you asked me what I thought about Texas. I didn't leave that stadium thinking any less of Texas. You know, this whole notion, is Texas back? Are they not back? I personally didn't think they did anything to make me feel, oh, boy, Texas.
Yeah.
Forget about them.
Uh-huh.
Man, I mean, they lost a game. But this is part of the beauty of being willing to play another top 10 opponent, is you lose a game and you maybe gain more street cred, so to speak. Like, I think people around the country probably left with an even more favorable impression of Sam Ehlinger and who Texas could potentially be this year. So we'll see where they go. Both teams go from here. But LSU blew my mind with their offensive approach and the performance of Joe Burrow. And I was very, very impressed with Texas as well, considering they were down big at one point. I think it was 20-7 at half, and obviously made a game of it and played well.
If those 8 plays though inside the 10-yard line,
yeah,
at 0 points, I mean that was the game. I tweeted a couple things out, and I was like, they're going to regret that the rest of the night in a game like this. And then
you're right.
The next morning, I jokingly tweeted out something to Booger McFarland and Spears and Ryan Clark that I had this dream that LSU had a quarterback that was fearless throwing the football, and that's what Burrow was. I mean, 471 yards, and the thing that really stood out is the deep balls, anything over 15 yards, he was 11 of 13 with 307 yards. When you have Burrow like that, how does that open up LSU the rest of the season in your mind?
Well, you know, I think, like we've said, from the time Alabama beat them in the national championship back in 2011, from that point on, they've been a shadow of themselves offensively. I mean, you're talking about OBJ and Jarvis Landry and Jeremy Hill all in the same offense, and yet you don't close your eyes and think about an LSU offense remotely close to what we saw Saturday night. You think about individual playmakers. You think of, oh, I remember that one time OBJ did this, mm-hmm, or Landry did that, or you know, or, but it was never wow. I mean, it's very, very hard to explain how they were a maximum protect, two or three wide receivers going out on routes kind of team. I formation, under center, old school. If there's still an offense left that was old school, it was LSU. And from Les Miles all the way through, that was just who they were. And it worked to a certain degree. I mean, it got them to 10 or 11 wins every year. They couldn't get over the hump and beat Alabama. And even with Leonard Fournette's of the world, they couldn't do it. So They looked in the mirror. I give Coach O a lot of credit and Steve Insminger, their offensive coordinator, a lot of credit to having the willingness to look and say, man, we have got to go open things up and get our athletes in space. And they looked around. They talked with people. And because they're in Baton Rouge and the Saints are in New Orleans, they visited probably every year with Sean Payton. Sean Payton just happened to hire a young guy. He's 29 years old, named Joe Brady, who earlier was with Joe Moorhead at Penn State. Spends some time with the Saints as a coach, learns a lot of things from Sean Payton and Drew Brees. And when he visits with the Saints, Sean Payton says, you know, this run pass option thing and the spread, we got a guy that I think you guys might want to talk to. And here comes Joe Brady. They visit. They have such a good visit. They want to say, hey, is there any way we could hire this guy? And they bring him in to be the passing game coordinator. And the willingness by Steve Insminger to say, I don't have an ego here. You don't have to run what I do. Let's bring this kid in and let's learn what he's doing and see if we can implement it into what we've been doing. And so you see a combination of who LSU's been and now who they are. Shotgun offense, almost every snap. And Joe Burrow, that's what he grew up on in high school and even at Ohio State. Last year, he looked like a fish out of water, mm-hmm, being under center. So he's back to what he is very, very comfortable with. And he goes out, and if you know Joe at all, he's kind of got a linebacker mentality playing quarterback. He's not afraid of anybody or any situation. And he steps right in, and you put this new offense with a quarterback with a tremendous upside and potential with just a tenacious, tough attitude, and it's like the perfect storm. Now it's 2 weeks, and I don't want to get carried away, but I kept saying during the broadcast, Alabama's taking notes right now. The SEC West is taking notice right now that things are different in Baton Rouge, and you got to believe they're only going to get better on that side of the ball, and it's going to be very, very exciting to see where Joe Burrow and Justin Jefferson, who, by the way, had a monster game, 9 catches, 163 yards, had the big catch late, 3 touchdowns. Jamar Chase had a big game, 8 catches. I mean, you talk about all we want about the quarterback play, but you need a good group of wide receivers. And the timing of this could not be any better because if you look at Jefferson and Chase and Marshall, haven't even talked about the tight ends that they have led by Thaddeus Moss. This is a a very, very good group to go with what Burrow's doing in this offense. So I don't think this was, you know, an aberration. I think this is who LSU's going to be, and it sets itself up for some fun showdowns down the road in the SEC.
And to your point, we have not even mentioned the running back situation at LSU, and I cannot remember a conversation in the last two decades where you're talking about LSU and their offense where you don't mention the backfield, but that just shows you the mindset of where this team is, who they have at quarterback. I like to look at rankings, early season rankings, as, hey, conversation. I don't take them seriously. I don't know how you view it, Herbie, but to me, it's more like, oh, okay, this is fun. Let's just have some fun here. They're fourth now in the new AP poll. Do you think fourth is the right spot behind Clemson, behind Alabama, behind Georgia, or do you think we just watched the second best team in the country, considering who they played and what they did early in the season?
It's 2 weeks in. It's very hard. I tweet out my top four every week at the end of the night, and when I got done initially leaving the stadium, I wanted to put him at one or two. And at the same time, you know, you got to go back and look who's out there. And I moved them ahead of Oklahoma and Georgia. And it's nothing that Oklahoma and Georgia haven't done. It's really more of a respect for what LSU has done. I mean, you play Texas and Austin and you win a game like that, you should be rewarded.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what the AP did. I have them at four as well. I had Clemson at one, Bama at two, Ohio State three, and LSU at four. And then Oklahoma and Georgia right there. And I'm one of these guys that I don't care about last year. I'm not, well, this team's a defending champ, so I'm looking at everything this year. And because of that, I'm very, very fluid with rankings. I think it's on potential and then what you see. And so for me, I think LSU can move up or down just depending on how they move forward. Same with Clemson, Bama, Ohio State, any of these teams. So the better the competition, the better you play, the more I think you should be rewarded for that, and you should move in the standings.
We'll be back in a minute to talk about the most surprising thing from week two. But first, a word from Allstate, because mayhem on Saturdays in the fall is inevitable. Mayhem happens on the field, off the field, and in the polls. Mayhem lives on the wind, in the rain, on the foot of an errant kick, and during a trap game. You'll find mayhem in the parking lot, during tailgates, charcoal that's not totally out, an errant football through a window, a flat tire, a lost side view mirror, etc., etc. You get the point. Allstate protects you from mayhem in the parking lot and outside it, at home and away. You can't stop mayhem from happening, but you can get better protected from it with Allstate. The potential for mayhem during the playoff race is rampant. Underdogs, trap games, unexpected weather, etc., etc., etc. Get better protected from mayhem with Allstate. Contact your local Allstate agent today. That's the best thing you saw on Saturday, that Burrow performance, LSU, Texas. What's the most surprising thing you saw over the weekend?
Well, there's a few, but I guess the most surprising probably was how dominant Maryland has looked in 2 weeks. They of course had a nice win to open the season to kind of get things started. But from what we saw last week, we all thought, okay, Syracuse potentially might be going to game day up at Syracuse for the big Clemson game. They battled Clemson the last couple years, but before that, they've got a tussle with Maryland that they've got to take care of, and we'll see how they do in that game. And they just went out and dominated that game. So I think the way Maryland has played in these first 2 weeks, I think they scored like 79 in the first game.
Yep.
I don't even care who you're playing.
Yep.
The next week they come up with 63 against Syracuse. And like you and I talked about in the opening podcast, so much made about Josh Gattis and coming over from Alabama, running the offense. And I kept saying, wait a second, Mike Locksley ran that offense at Alabama. You were a part of the staff. Dan Enos was part of the staff. And I'm not saying you didn't have something to do with it, but the alpha in that room was Mike Locksley. He's now the coach at Maryland, and Maryland is humming right now on offense. Michigan's still trying to maybe find their identity. Miami's still trying to kind of find an identity. But Mike Locksley inherits Josh Jackson from Virginia Tech, so he gets a veteran quarterback who did the grad transfer. And you get a very, very talented group of running backs. And, boy, they are running, they're throwing, and they've got a kind of a presence about them right now that Big Ten East is kind of deep waters with Ohio State and Michigan and Michigan State and Penn State. Now you throw Maryland and that offense in there. It'd be a fun year to see who can survive that gauntlet. That was the biggest surprise to me, is how dominating they look.
142 points this season in two games, tied for the third most through a team's first two games of the season. And I don't want to jump the gun, but Maryland is a sleeping giant, especially with their location and the talent that they could bring in. And it feels like injuries have cost them the last couple of years. They've got five or six guys, when you look at weapons and options, that could play on Sunday. And we're starting to see Locksley open things up. And then to have a quarterback like Jackson, who we saw him as a freshman at Virginia Tech, he looks the part physically. And you're like, okay, can somebody tap into that? And it feels like they're just getting into scratching the surface here with this offense, especially with a ground attack.
Yeah, no doubt about that. For him, you know, he gained some valuable experience. I think he had like 16 starts over at Virginia Tech. And then he comes back, decides he wants to be part of what Mike Locksley, does as a play caller, makes a good call there. You're right. I mean, what they have in that backfield is terrifying. I mean, it's led by Anthony McFarland, but there's depth there with Leak and Fleet Davis. I mean, they can do some great things. And now people are going to get some film on them. It's going to get tougher. People are going to try to come up with a plan. They're no longer going to surprise people with that kind of firepower. But still, you got to stop them. And, you know, through the first couple of weeks, I don't know if anybody's gained more confidence than maybe North Carolina and Mac Brown, but as far as making a big splash and getting up into the top 25, than what we've seen from Maryland. So that was the one that was most surprising. Army going toe to toe with Michigan and controlling that game and really having a chance to win that game in regulation.
Oh, yeah.
That surprised me. I thought Michigan with Don Brown and their defense, the way they play, I thought it'd be very hard for Army to do what Army does, like they did against Oklahoma, control the ball, shorten the game, take the air out of the ball, keep it away. But to their credit, they were able to do that. And if there's a frustrating or kind of scratch your head moment, it's what's going on with Michigan and their offense? I mean, I, you know, all these offensive linemen returned. This is the year that everybody's talking about. They're the team to beat in the Big Ten, and they didn't look great against Middle Tennessee. They come back against Army, a team that they're physically much more stronger and powerful and more athletic than. And, you know, you could say whatever you want. Oh, Army surprised them. No, they didn't. I mean, everybody knows about Army, and Army's offense is one thing, you know, dealing with that. But the Army defense, They weren't intimidated at all by that offensive line or Shea Patterson. And Michigan still, it's like I keep saying, they're stuck in third gear and they're trying to find who they are and try to get their playmakers going. But right now they're just out of sorts. They're not into a rhythm at all.
Patterson does not look right. And the three early fumbles in that first half, I mean, the second one, you look at protection and then you, when you look at the final numbers, they ran the ball and you're sitting there, you're like, wait a second, this still looks like Harbaugh's offense. I'm not sure this is Josh Gattis' offense against Army. And then I start to wonder how much longer before we're going to see Dylan McCaffrey more in this offense running the zone read. And Harbaugh after the game was, it felt like he was trying to protect Patterson afterwards, but no touchdowns. He just doesn't look confident in the pocket running this offense. It just, you have to wonder, they got the bye and how they're going to play things out. And I feel bad for Army. I mean, last year, that game on the road at Oklahoma, it felt like they had it. They had this game at 14-7 and they have to throw the ball there off that fullback considering what happened with the offsides. And it's just a heartbreak. They throw the pick and suddenly the momentum for Michigan turns the other way. I feel so bad for the Black Knights because this team isn't as good as they were last year. And then for them to go to the Big House and do what they did and continue to punch back no matter what Michigan did, it's a heartbreak. I felt like they deserve to get that dub.
When you think of Army, there a lot of people probably don't follow Army until they play Navy. But Jeff Monken is in his sixth year now. It's amazing to think he's been there for 6 years. But he's from that same coaching tree as Paul Johnson, Coach Ken, and what he does at Navy. In fact, he was with Navy, brought the Navy system. He played, by the way, at Georgia Southern. So he's kind of in that coaching tree, playing in it, coached in it, brought that same philosophy to Army. Before he got there, the previous 3 years, Army won three, they won two, they won three. They made a change, brought him in. And there's some initial struggles. They won four, they won two, and from 2016 on, they go 8-5, 10-3, 11-2 last year, and ended up playing Houston, by the way, in a bowl game, beat them 70-14. You're right. That was a great team, a veteran team, and now they come back this year. I think I'm a big believer in the system. I'm a big believer, by the way, in Jeff Monken as a coach. I think he's an outstanding coach for where he is, or really if he ends up getting hired somewhere else, I think he's outstanding. So they're not into moral victories. They're not into, oh, shucks, you went to Lincoln or you went to Norman last year and you battled. This year you did a good job of going into Ann Arbor. You know, when you win 11 games in a year, you're confident you can win a game. They did everything that they needed to be able to win it. But like you said, they leave frustrated, but a team that continues to gain a lot of respect and probably a team that has a chance to win a lot of games before they get ready for the Army-Navy game in the middle of December. I think it's December 14th this year.
It is. It is. Yeah. And you mentioned a team that could win a few games. I mean, they have a chance looking at their schedule. They have a chance. Army has a chance to win 9 games here.
Easy.
Which is incredible. It's like you said, and I'm sure this game was scheduled Michigan Army when they were a 2-3 win team. And you're thinking at the time the ADs are setting this whole thing up and they're like, we're going to be good. We're going to be good. We'll just get Army on the schedule. And then obviously things have changed with Monken and what he has done the last few years. Yeah. In your mind, who had the biggest win? And you think, do you think it's Maryland, or considering they beat Syracuse? I know they were favorites, but who do you think had the biggest win over the weekend? Is it LSU?
I think LSU had the biggest win. You know, I think Maryland had the whoa. Did you see that kind of win? And then I think there's a game that is probably off the radar for most people, but for me, I just happened to I stayed up late and was watching it. It was the game that was delayed out in Seattle. What Cal did. Now, remember, Cal ended up beating Washington a year ago, and a lot of people thought, you know, it's one thing to beat them, maybe sneak up on them with a good defense last year. No way they're going to go to Seattle, right, and be able to beat Washington this year. And that game, I think, was a huge win because the Pac-12, I mean, you tell me, outside of you thought Washington or you thought Oregon – you know, anytime you can win and make a name for yourself, you know, all of a sudden throw your hat in the discussion. Now, what does Cal do with this?
Uh-huh.
Can they, you know, they got off to a good start last year. They were 3-0. And then after that, the wheels came off and they lost 3 in a row. So this is some players, especially on defense. It's a great defense, one of the tops in the Pac-12. Have they learned from last year? Are they going to keep this in perspective, just kind of keep going down week to week to week? I love their head coach. He's in his third year now, Justin Wilcox. He's been around as a great defensive coordinator. He spent some time, you know, at Tennessee. He was at Wisconsin. In fact, left Wisconsin to go become the head coach. So he's outstanding on that side of the ball, and I think he's proving to be a great head coach. But I think Cal had a big win, and I just want to see what they can do with it from this point on.
And then you look at Washington. No one's making excuses. 2.5-hour weather delay. It ended well past midnight, but they blitzed. The Cal defense blitzed, and Jacob Eason, he didn't look sharp. The two early turnovers, and for me, it's the first time at Washington that Chris Peterson has ever been beaten at home as a double-digit favorite. The way this Pac-12 is set up, I feel terrible that we have to continue to bring up the narrative, because when you look at certain teams winning, you don't say, okay, it's for the conference. But when you look at what Oregon did last week, what Washington, like, you move on to the next thing, you're like, okay, Washington still has a chance here for this entire conference. Now we're down to Utah, and then the surprise in a week where it was like, all right, write them off is what we saw from USC and what they did to Stanford, especially with their comeback.
I know. I love USC. If you know Clay Helton at all, I mean, here he is dealing with not only the competition, but to a certain extent, dealing with his own fan base. You know, I mean, there are a lot of them who want to see him lose, and they want to go out and try to hire, you know, quote unquote, Urban Meyer, Bob Stoops, you know, chase that big name. Meanwhile, they got a good coach. They got a great coach. Things haven't gone the way they had hoped. So they're ready to kind of out with the old, in with the new kind of approach. And he's been dealing with that really since he's been there. And God bless him for maintaining a positive attitude. But he's in his fifth year there. And I remember, I think it was 16. They lost to Alabama. They played Max Brown. They lost to Stanford. I think the next week maybe they started Sam Darnold. And they were sitting there. They lost that game. They're 1-3. And it was a foregone conclusion. It was already, I remember talking to people. It was like, all right, you think they're going to go for Tom Herman? Do you think they're going to go maybe this guy, that guy? Who's a better? I mean, it was almost as if it's a done deal. And all they did in 16 is end up winning the rest of their games. And they ended up beating Penn State in an epic Rose Bowl with Saquon going against Sam Darnold. And they ended up winning that game. It was 52-49. And it was like, okay, now we like him again. We like him again. And then 17 happened and 18. And it's like they've been trying to replace him as a fan base since he arrived. And I'm with you. The gauntlet that they have, Fresno, Stanford, at BYU, Utah, at Washington, at Notre Dame. I mean, if you somehow were to get to 3-3, God forbid 4-2, with JT Daniels, it would be heroic effort for anybody to go through that gauntlet before they get ready for the second half that's much more manageable. But then you lose your starting quarterback, JT Daniels, and you go to a guy that's never really played as a true freshman, and now you got Stanford, and they put it on Stanford 45-20. Maybe that's the game. Maybe the more we're talking about it, that might be with Keaton Slovis stepping in there and just throwing dimes all over the place. I have a new vote. I'm going to go USC.
USC, right?
Probably had the biggest win.
It's crazy because a week ago we're trying to figure out, okay, how do we pronounce the kid's name? He's a true freshman from Arizona and his only like, you know, claim to fame is that Kurt Warner was his quarterback coach in high school. But this just shows you, you know, the nuance in recruiting. He's a three-star. He gets two offers from SC and Oregon State in the Pac-12. And then what does he do? He throws for nearly 85% best completion percentage in a 300-yard passing performance by any quarterback in USC history. And true freshman leading the comeback, and he starts hearing the chants MVP, MVP. In the stands, it's incredible. And if this young man survives the next 5 weeks, like we've talked about with their schedule, I mean, you have to start to consider, all right, Clay Helton deserves to stay here. Graham Harreld and this air raid offense, they need to develop this kid because he came in fourth on the depth chart. And as the spring, he came in as an early enrollee. As the spring went on, and then as the summer went on, he surpasses Sears. He surpasses Fink to be number two. And that, I heard that battle was really good and tight with JT Daniels. Of course, I hear it after the game, but I've heard that the USC coaches are really high on this kid. It just shows you that sometimes the assumptions can't be made, especially when we're talking about 18-22-year-old kids. And Slovis deserves, I think Helton deserves a ton of credit this week after that performance against Stanford.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you just said it all. I mean, we couldn't even pronounce his name.
Yeah.
And in an era where everybody's a name, everybody's an Elite 11, everybody's this, everybody's that, he kind of slips through the cracks even though he goes to USC. And even when they were having this battle on the outside looking in, there were names like Jack Sears and Matt Fink and, oh yeah, there's this freshman they have out of Scottsdale. I think is it Keaton? Yeah, Keaton Slovis. And as you said, now there's stories starting to emerge that Daniels barely held him off. And in fact, there's the transfer portal. I mean, some of these quarterbacks, I think Fink left, came back. Sears is, or vice versa. I know one of them left, came back in April.
Fink.
Yeah. And Sears ended up leaving after it was announced that maybe not only did he lose out to JT Daniels, but he ended up losing out to Slovis as well. And that game, by the way, early was a battle. I mean, it was back and forth and, you know, it's not as if it's, oh, no problem to beat David Shaw and, and the Cardinal. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's a credit to them for being able to find a way to win. And in fact, they were down at one point. Think about this: being down and playing at home with the way things have gone. How do you think the vibe in the Coliseum was at 17-3?
Yep,
you know.
Yep,
it's 17-3, and you're on the hot seat. And you got a freshman that nobody's ever heard of, and you come back and not only take the lead, but blow them out 45-20, and your quarterback goes from nobody knowing who he is to you beat Stanford, and now everybody say, oh, yeah, let me tell you about this Slovis.
I mean, exactly.
It's amazing what 60 minutes of football can do, especially early in the year, to change people's opinions. And now, you know, they go to BYU, which is coming off – BYU's coming off a big win against Tennessee. They're a great coach there, and they'll be fired up to see those beautiful uniforms coming in to Provo, and that'll have them inspired. If you survive that, you got Utah, who everybody's picking to win the Pac-12. Could be maybe a preview of the Pac-12 championship. They're coming to the Coliseum. Then you go to Seattle. They're already in desperation mode. They can't afford to lose their second game. I mean, that's what they're facing in these next 3 weeks, a bye week. And if they survive, they're still standing. They got to go to South Bend in a rivalry game to take on Brian Kelly and Ian Book and company. So, I mean, hold on. Welcome to college football, Keaton Slovis. And don't get too comfortable, because we're playing a lot of big time competition here in the next 4 or 5 games.
If they win 3 of the next 4 games, Clay Helton deserves consideration to stay and maybe get an extension of his contract.
Oh my gosh.
And this is not me all over Clay Helton on just one game. It just shows you the dramatic turn of events, like you mentioned, in 60 minutes. They score the final 35 points. SC now, completely different vibe, especially now that you saw Oregon get an L last week, Washington an L, and now you start thinking, okay, well, wait a second now. These other teams are all falling apart. Do we have a shot at talking about the conference? Now, the opposite feeling of that experience, do we have a shot, is Clemson. And a lot of people, I myself included, thought this weekend was going to be the toughest weekend at Texas A&M, because I thought that they were going to be able to handle Syracuse. And now that what happened with Syracuse, there's a lot of questions on what we're going to see on Saturday night in prime time between Syracuse and Clemson. But to me, Clemson's team and that performance against A&M, and when you look at the score, it's so misleading, because they were going to win by 20 points or double digits and continue that streak that they had. Their performance, especially that defense, showed me so much on how they responded against Kellen Mond and Jimbo Fisher's offense. And I thought Brett Venables and what he did with the safeties and how he viewed this game. Like, he was like, okay, a year ago you did what you wanted to do with me, I'm going to answer back. What were your thoughts and impressions on how Clemson looked as a team, especially on the defensive side?
Well, that's the thing that all week we talked about Kellen Mond and Jimbo Fisher and 430 yards and the way they had their way with Clemson, who ended up having a magical year of winning them all 15-0 and winning the national title. And we all kind of pointed to that game, and here it was round two. Well, Brent Venables is the top defensive coordinator in the country for a reason. And as he's doing his due diligence for the 2019 season, I'm sure he pulls out the Kellen Mond film and use that to learn for the entire year of how to get better. But specifically, he and Jimbo Fisher, they went toe-to-toe with Florida State and Clemson for a number of years. They're very, very familiar with one another's scheme. And I felt the scheme had as much to do with the success of A&M in the game at Kyle Field as Kellen Mond. I thought Jimbo Fisher put Kellen Mond, who played extraordinarily well, I thought that he put him in a position to have some success. He had some receivers that were open downfield, and that day he was accurate. Now you fast forward to what we just watched 8 months later, 8 or 9 months later, and what was the difference? Number one, coming into Death Valley, obviously a different set of challenges. Clemson did not have that defensive line that they had a year ago, so you'd think there might be a potential advantage up there, but Venables always changing things up, always giving you a different picture, puts a lot on the quarterback. I thought, as much as we talked about the quarterback, they negated their ability to run the ball. I think they were held to, when it was all said and done, I think they averaged 2 yards a carry, 53 yards for the game. Close your eyes and you think about that game. Do you think about A&M running the ball at all?
No.
And when Jimbo's really going, he likes to run the ball to set up what he likes to do in the passing game. It's not just we're going to air out with Kellen Mond, even though he gets a lot of the credit. There's a fear factor there with their running game. They couldn't run the ball. Linebackers were making plays. The safeties were making plays in open field, and it put Mond into a position where he had to throw, and that's where I thought he mixed up the looks. You talked about the safeties. It was just blitzing the corner off the boundary. Just a lot of different things that they did that, to me, prevented A&M from ever really getting into any kind of rhythm. And this was not a blowout, but it just, as you watch the game, Clemson scored early on the scramble, and it just never was in doubt. It was just one of those games. Could Clemson have looked better? Sure. But did you ever question who dominated the game or who's going to win the game? No. Not
once,
at all.
Right.
So,
and it's
yeah,
scary.
So, yeah, it is. It is
we
scary.
We didn't see ETN go off. I mean, they got him in the passing game a little bit, but that's what's scary. One of their biggest weapons a week earlier was dominant, and we didn't even have to see him to be dominant. And Trevor Lawrence wasn't, I mean, he was much better than he was in the opener, but he wasn't like Trevor Lawrence that we saw in the national championship game. He was good. He wasn't great.
Well, I think Mike Elko, the defensive coordinator from Texas A&M, who's very, very good in his own right, he thought, okay, we cannot give up the big play. You know, I know he scrambled, he made a few plays, and the receivers, you know, the length that they have with Higgins and Ross made some plays, but let's go into this thing. If you gotta pick your poison when you go up against Clemson. You know, you've got ETN and how explosive he can be in the running game. So you gotta be mindful of that. You've got the vertical threats with the length and what they can do with Ross and Higgins. You gotta be worried about that. So where are you gonna start? And I felt like they were willing to try to win things up front with some slanting and angling and linebacker play. Hopefully we can hold up there. Let's just not give up the big play in the pass game. And I think all things considering, at the end of the day, you know, I think Lawrence ended up throwing for, 268?
Yeah.
But they kept the big play away for the most part and did a pretty good job of holding up. I mean, when we look back at the year, I bet we'll look at A&M's defense, only giving up 24, as one of the best jobs all year of defending the big playability of the Clemson offense with Lawrence and all his weapons that he has around him.
That late touchdown, too, by A&M, it snapped a notable streak for the Tigers. Clemson had won 11 straight games by at least 20 points, and it was the second longest streak in the AP poll era. You got to go back to 1936. A year ago, Alabama won 12 consecutive games when everybody was on the Tua train by at least 20 points. What's the one thing when you look at this Clemson team that you, I don't want to say are concerned, but that they should be mindful when we look at the rest of the schedule and it plays out where they, in week two, it was their toughest matchup on paper. What's the one thing that concerns you? Because it looks like it's an undefeated season all the way to the playoff, and then we'll start talking in the playoff.
Well, I think the back end is as good as there is in the country with the way that the experience that they have, and moving Kendrick from receiver over to corner up to this point looks outstanding. A.J. Terrell, Kayvon Wallace, Tanner Muse, Nolan Turner's playing great. I mean, their back end, Isaiah Simmons, who I consider, even though he's kind of that hybrid nickel backer, he's part of that. I mean, that's as good as you will see in the country. I think that Skalski coming back, 47, I love him as a player. He's physical. He's kind of become, you know, the leader inside with Kendall Joseph moving on. He's kind of taking on more of that role. Chad Smith is a journeyman, kind of a guy that's been around, has had to wait his turn. So I think all that right now appears to be what you'd expect from Clemson. I can't wait to see. I mean, let's face it, when you lose what they lost up front with Farrell, Austin Bryant, Dexter Lawrence, of course, Christian Wilkins, that group, I mean, as good as they were, it leaves a huge void. So Xavier Thomas has flashed to me on that defensive line, but as the season goes on, who else is going to start to make plays for them as far as rushing the quarterback? You know, when they go into these games where they can't always, you know, let's say a team says, we got to take Xavier Thomas' ability to get to the quarterback away, how are they going to get there? Are they going to have to blitz? Can Logan Rudolph get there? Can other players get there? Because they last year were spoiled with pressuring opposing teams. I think they ended up with 54 sacks, which is incredible. So that's the one area that I think we're going to see them continue to grow as they gain experience and guys get better and better, is that defensive line. So that would be the one area I'm not necessarily questioning, but I just want to see more of these new faces, that used to be part-time. And now they're needing to go and play the whole game. I can't wait to see if they can be as dominant as they're going to need to be. They don't have to be Christian Wilkins, Dexter Lawrence, you know, dominant, but just in their own right, can they be dominant players up front?
We'll be back in a minute with Herbie's thoughts on week three. But first, a word from Carhartt. You know who works hard? Rookies. Sure, they make mistakes, but no one's got more to prove. Knowing each day's another opportunity to outwork them all and earn the respect they deserve. Point is, no one outworks a rookie. That's why after 130 years, Carhartt is still approaching each day with the passion and work ethic of a company that's 130 years young. Same hunger, same determination, same giant chip on the shoulder. And in the same way a rookie needs to work hard to earn the respect of their peers, everything Carhartt makes has to keep earning the respect of the hardworking people who wear it. That's why Carhartt still works like a rookie, and why Carhartt will keep outworking them all for the next 130 years, too. Visit Carhartt.com/CFB to learn more and shop this season's hardest working gear.
When you look at the rest of the week three schedule, are there any games that stand out? I mean, we don't have the sexy on paper matchups that we had for week two, but is there anything you want to see when it comes to matchups?
Yeah. I think that there are a few that stand out to me. The one that I'm really looking forward to, besides, you know, going to the Carrier Dome, I haven't been there in years. It's going to be fun to go there. Iowa State with College Game Day, going in. That's a fun one because it's a big war every year within that state. And now with Iowa State really coming on, there's more at stake than just Iowa State trying to pull off an upset. I mean, Iowa State's trying to do big things now with Matt Campbell. So, that'll be a good one. I think Florida and Kentucky is a nice one. I think that's at, 7 o'clock this week, ESPN game. Mm-hmm. We all know what Kentucky did last year with Mark Stoops. He's playing up this whole disrespect thing, and he should, because many people expect them to just kind of go back into the corner after the magical year that they had a year ago. People are kind of expecting them to just fall way back and be near the bottom of the SEC East. They win 10 games a year ago, and I think this game last year really propelled them into the year that they had when they won at the Swamp. Now they get them back in Lexington, and I think if there's the game of the week that's going to be chippy and physical, it's Florida with the way Felipe Franks seems to want to chirp, going up against Kentucky, a team that plays with a chip on their shoulder. And the fact that Kentucky beat them last year, mm-hmm. Florida's going to come in with a little bit of their own chip. So that game to me, could at the end of the day be the most physical game of the entire weekend.
Yeah, I'm with you, because I kind of want to see how Florida responds going on the road after what happened in Gainesville, because you don't see Kentucky go to Gainesville and get a win.
Right.
And so for that experience last year and then for that team to respond, I can't wait. I want to see, like you mentioned, the Iowa State experience. Ames will be rocking with you guys at College Game Day. And here's one game, too. Arizona State, Michigan State, right?
Yep.
I think Herm and what happened last year and how they won that game. And D'Antonio, now that game's in East Lansing this year, and D'Antonio a little chippy about his offense and a little ticked off about the way his offense has started out this season, because that defense is outstanding. That's another game to circle.
I would give you one more. We just talked quite a bit about USC. USC has, I think, an exciting game going up against BYU.
Yeah.
And BYU coming off that win, has refound some of the confidence that maybe they missed after losing the opening weekend. And anytime you've got to go to Provo, it's always a challenging game. And USC playing with their backup, now starting true freshman quarterback in Slovis, and all the excitement of the win over Stanford, the way they played, And now they got to come back down to earth and get ready for more of that gauntlet we talked about. And they've got to be able to go on the road and get ready to take on BYU and see if they can survive that one and keep moving down the road.
All right, I'll be a little homer here. My final thought on this is I kind of want to see Maryland go to Temple in Philadelphia and see what it's like to get punched a little bit and see, because that Temple defense is going to be feisty for a game like this. And a year ago, let's not forget, Maryland knocked off Texas. They were feeling really good. And then a week later, Temple came down there and surprised Maryland. Yeah. And so all that feel-good moment for knocking off the Longhorns went out the door immediately after the Owls and what they did. So now they go to Philadelphia with revenge on their mind.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing Rod Carey's bunch and how Mike Locksley answers that with his offense.
And for Rod Carey, it's a chance to try all the new messaging, new attitude, trying to get his players to buy in to the way things are going to be done now. And it'd be interesting to see if at the very least they can play that typical Temple tough and really challenge Maryland. That's one thing about inheriting a new program, in Maryland's case with Mike Locksley. Have a big win like that and really send a message. And there's a reason you're there. It's because they haven't learned how to win consistently. And now, Can they just block out all the compliments and show up and be ready to play and a team that's always going to challenge your manhood in Temple? So, hey, that's a good one. I like that one.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. My fingers will be crossed, and obviously I'll be a little tight on Saturday.
You against Scotty Van Pelt.
Yeah, yeah. We do it every year. We got tasty cakes on the line, so we'll see how this plays out. I enjoyed my tasty cakes last year, so every year we've always have a gentleman's bet, and obviously you got one on Tirico last week. This week I hope that his streak stops, so we'll see how this plays out.
Good luck.
Herbie, have a great time in Ames. Cannot wait for College Game Day for that experience on Saturday, and of course, I will see you on SportsCenter tomorrow.
Yes, sir. Have a great week. Always great to join you. And let's have some fun this week with week three in college football.
Thanks, buddy.
See ya.
Want to thank Kirk Herbstreit for joining us to get his thoughts on the weekend's biggest storylines. We also want to thank our sponsors, Allstate and Carhartt, for today's episode. By the way, if you want to peek behind the scenes of college football and take a look at a program like never before, check out Miles to Go. As Les Miles works to return Kansas football to national prominence, new episodes debut every Thursday exclusively on Big 12 Now on ESPN+. Big thanks to our producer for the last couple of weeks, Gabe Bassane. If you enjoy this podcast and want more, all you have to do is subscribe to the CFB podcast with Herbie and Pollock. And of course, remember to rate and review. We certainly appreciate it. Ahead on Wednesday, Pollock joins us along with Ivan Maisel with his very latest episode, which highlights the 150-year anniversary of college football. Enjoy the week.